So my name is Alex Kelly, and I'm sitting here with Kristen Rouse at Mid-Manhattan Library. It's October 2nd, 2013. And I just want to start out by asking you, Kristen, a little bit about where you came from.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I'm originally from Florida, born and raised. I was born in Miami. My family moved to the Orlando area. I grew up in Seminole County, Florida, about a little ways northeast of Orlando. And that's where I spent, you know, from age, I think, like 3 or 4 until I left home after high school. And then I lived in Tallahassee for a while, and I went to Florida State University straight out of high school, and like many college students, I wasn't quite ready for it. And so I ended up dropping out and kind of collecting myself and working some jobs and realizing, you know, it's if you work at fast food restaurants and work at like those entry level sort of job, minimum wage jobs, that really only prepares you for more minimum wage jobs. And so I decided, you know, at one point, like I need to do something. I need to make a change in my life. I need to, you know, I want to be more. I want to be better. And then after some weeks of thought, I was like, you know, my dad was in the Army when he, you know, was looking to do something better with his life. And so, you know, he joined the Army in the 1950s and did his few years of service. And I thought, well, I could do that, but I don't want to commit to active duty. So I'll join the Army Reserve. And I remember talking to my dad on the phone and saying, this is what I want to do. And he's like, oh, no. You don't want to join the Army. So you want to join the Air Force. And of course, like any good daughter, I did exactly what he said not to do. So I joined the Army Reserve and went through basic training in 1994. And I moved, I also decided to make the move to a different town. I decided I needed some city in my life, so I moved to New Orleans, which is not too far away from the Florida Panhandle. And so I started out there in the 4010th Army Hospital, which is an Army Reserve hospital that was at that time at the New Orleans lakefront. And so I started out there as a PV2, which is a private, but I got a little leg up because I had some college credits, and so I started out there in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Can you tell me about some of the memories from basic training, what you remember from that first experience?
So I didn't know what to expect. I never watched the movies that tell you like what basic training was like for anybody, and you know, I always go into something like that, as I have many times, thinking, oh well, how bad can it be? And it was pretty rough. it was pretty rough. Even, you know, and anybody who went through basic training like a long time ago will say like, oh, that's nothing. Just like, you know, now I look at people who go through basic training now and think, oh, that's nothing. We had such a hard time when we went through basic training.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess everybody's basic training is the hardest as it gets. But so in 1994, in the summer of 94, which is when I went, they sent me to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, which a lot of people call Fort Lost in the Woods, Missouri, which it's sort of like in the Ozarks, I guess. And that's really the only place in Missouri I've ever been. But they were starting, a new program. It was sort of a pilot program for reintegrating men and women together in basic training, which I guess they tried in the 70s and then they discontinued it. And so the traditional basic training for a long time was, you know, men go to this basic training and then women go to this other basic training at either Fort Jackson or at Fort Leonard Wood. And so what they tried with us was having, I think there were maybe 14 or 15 women to each platoon of like 40 people. And so, and nobody coming into this expected that. Everybody expected it to be the traditional, oh, you're either with women or with men, depending on which one you are. And so, like, the guys were very disappointed to have women in the platoon with them. And they didn't have the building set up for us yet, really, and they kind of didn't know what to do with us and at other times. And so, you know, so add to that basic training, you know, like where they yell at you a lot and single you out and make you feel really sad that you did this, and, you know, and they take all your personal possessions away, and you're only wearing what they tell you to wear, and you're only doing what they tell you to do, and, you know, like down to the, like, can I please use the restroom type of thing, like they're yelling at you for that, and, you know, so, like, just every aspect of your life is controlled. Then put this layer on top of it where you introduce this whole new thing of, you know, like, yeah, men and women are together in school and all, you know, all this and that, but it just, it defied everyone's expectations, and you kind of, some people were kind of hostile about it, some people were disappointed, some people were, wow, great, I'm getting the real training that I signed up for, and then it just really was such a mishmash. But by the end of the basic training cycle, I feel like we really did in a lot of ways, you know, come together and kind of bridge some of those gaps in understanding, and it was, you know, it felt kind of like a, you know, like we're breaking new ground here, you know, in addition to the, like, wow, I just finished something that was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was, at that time, the hardest thing I've ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And lousy food and, you know, KP and running around on rifle ranges and all kind of stuff. But I remember Fort Leonard Wood being a really beautiful place. And I'd love to see that scenery again, just, you know, obviously not in that context exactly.
Yeah. So after you finished basic training, how long was that?
It's 8 weeks. Pretty sure it's 8 weeks, yeah.
Okay.
So it was a while
time
ago.
Was probably.
Yeah, and because, like, I want to be able to say, like, yeah, with authority, yes, it's 8 weeks, and I'm pretty
yeah.
sure it's 8 weeks.
And then you went to New Orleans after that?
Yeah,
okay.
So I did, there's an option that you can take if you sign up for the reserve, where you can do your basic training one summer, and then you can live your life or go to school or do your thing, and then within a year you have to go back for they call it AIT, Advanced Individual Training, or it's like your job school. You know, so basic training is what everybody gets, and then your AIT is your specific job training. And so, the following summer, I went to San Antonio, Texas, for I think it was like it was 8 or 12 weeks somewhere in that neighborhood of training for medical supply. So San Antonio is Fort Sam Houston is where they train the Army's Medical Corps, and I wasn't a medic, but I was doing, like, basically medical logistics, kind of at that ground level, you know, doing, like, warehousing and ordering of medical supplies, which they keep separate from everything else that you order, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
so, like, medical logistics is kind of its own thing, and then all the rest of the logistics is its other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in a reserve hospital unit that was kind of like a temp agency for medical personnel to include supply.
Mm-hmm.
And so so we just drilled every month, kind of doing, like, you know, housekeeping, kind of, you know, admin stuff, and then a lot of what I was doing in my monthly drills was ordering people's uniforms, which has nothing to do with medical supplies, but they're like, oh, your supply, just here, get us stuff. And so you kind of learn a little bit of both sides of supply. And then I did get to do some summer training events that were in actual, like, the big deployable hospitals that they set up, you know, with the big tents and, you know, like the containerized operating rooms and stuff like that. And so I had an opportunity for a few different summer trainings where where I was functioning as a medical supply person in that deployable hospital in an exercise. You know, so we got to go to Camp Parks, California, to Fort McCoy, Wisconsin, and just, you know, in these big giant fields, you know, actually build the hospitals and get it all up and running to do exercises where, you know, where they're treating dummy, like these, you know, plastic dummies as patients and doing
mm-hmm.
different scenarios like that. So that was, I feel like that was the best training that I had. And I ended up being in that unit for 10 years. And so I went from the rank of PV2, E2. I got promoted to be a sergeant. And then I was promoted to staff sergeant by the end of my 10 years
mm-hmm.
in that unit. And, you know, and I went to some of my, like, non-commissioned officer training schools and that type of thing in summer training.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all really great experiences and were really a part of sort of who I would become. It was sort of like life training skills,
mm-hmm.
you know, to have that as sort of an ongoing presence in my life, you know, like I knew some of the same people for those full 10 years, you know, in that unit, and I'm still in touch with a few folks, because it was kind of like a family, because you sort of see, you know, who gets married, who gets divorced, who has kids, whose kids are growing up, you know, that type of thing, to have that kind of longevity with an organization in that unique way.
Mm. How did it feel to become a sergeant when you got to that point in your career?
I still tell people the best rank in the Army is E5, is a sergeant.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's where you have the most responsibility, I think, because you came up through the ranks and, you know, you came up through the ranks and you have peers and you get promoted ahead of your peers. And so it's like you're recognized for being a leader amongst your peer group. And so it's hard to do to kind of step up and say, okay, it's my time to lead now. You know, so it's kind of like a rite of passage. It's a way of growing up, you know, professionally as well as personally. And the Army really, you know, when it's working right, and it often does, you know, it puts the most work on those E5s, you know, to take care of the people immediately under them. You know, they're the squad leaders, they're the team leaders, you know, like they're the ones who really make sure that everything gets done, you know, because if they're not doing their job, the whole thing falls apart. And so, you know, like every rank above E5 depends on the E5 to get it done, you know. So like,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, you're the one getting your friends to, or getting, you know, the people you work with to listen to you and to, you know, to buck up and, you know, stand in line and, you know, get what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a typical day as an E5?
Well, so then after my 10 years in the reserve,
mm-hmm.
so I made it to the rank of E6, but when, like, so this was like in 2003, so we all watched, you know, in 2001 when, you know, like 9/11 happened, and even though we're, you know, in the South on the Gulf Coast, I'd actually moved back to Tallahassee at that point, but was commuting back to New Orleans to be in the same unit because I just felt that level of affinity for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never wanted to transfer out of the unit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but so we all kind of watched together this thing unfolding, and reserve units were getting activated, active divisions were getting, you know, active organizations, and then later divisions were getting sent over to Afghanistan, and we thought, all right, our number's going to come up for Afghanistan. So like everybody really started to talk in a serious way about like, let's make sure we really know what we're doing, you know, so that once we hit the ground, like we can be assets, you know, because like, you know, like I mentioned, on that month to month basis, you know, we weren't doing medical supply necessarily. We were like, you know, ordering uniforms and, you know, my boots are too big, my boots are too small, I got fat, I got skinny, you know, like, you know, helping
mm-hmm.
people get clothes that fit them, which, okay, that's great, but that doesn't necessarily help you if you get shoved in a hospital and all of a sudden you need to be having life-saving products and the right ones, you know, in the right quantities to the right healthcare providers. You know, like, lives depend on the supplies that you're able to bring through the system
mm-hmm.
effectively, right? So everybody took it seriously. And so we're sitting there, we're doing the processing, we're getting all of our paperwork ready, like, to go over. A few of our doctors ended up being pulled to go over in Afghanistan. There was a story where, like, someone in our medical brigade, like, some doctors ended up on horseback, you know, or on, you know, the back of donkeys or whatever, like, in, you know, with the Northern Alliance in those
mm-hmm.
early days before, you know, I mean, it was game on. But we were just sort of waiting in the wings to see, well, what's going to happen with little 40-10th Army Hospital in New Orleans. And our number did not come up at that time. And by the time 2003 rolled around, there'd been the entire ramp up to the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, and whatever anybody's, like, political thoughts were on Iraq, and they, you know, and we had the full spectrum of opinion, you know, within our ranks, but everybody wanted to be able to do the job if they were called, because, you know, like, you don't want the war to happen, and, you know, you're training all these years, and you miss it, you know, I mean, because you train to do your job, when needed, you know, and so we were looking at it from that angle, but then as soon as the invasion started, like, there was a group from our unit that did get deployed to Kuwait, and then they're kept, you know, rumors ranged wildly, as they will, about deployments, and
mm-hmm.
and we actually had our full-time staff saying, oh, yeah, you're definitely going to be in Kuwait by, you know, by this month or by this date or whatever, and it never came.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the orders never came, and so, you know, I had finished grad school by then, and, you know, I'm trying to work a job, and, you know, and I'd majored in English, which,
mm-hmm.
you know, gets me back to the minimum wage jobs, you know,
yeah.
that made me think, oh, I need a college education,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, I didn't get so far as, you know, what is my college education, and then
mm-hmm.
what's my job plan after that, you know, and so, I, you know, I was teaching, you know, as an adjunct at the community college in Tallahassee, working some for the State Department of Education, and you know, and all this back and forth of, like, yeah, you're going, no, you're not, yeah, you're going, no, you're not. I'm like, this is for the birds. I have got to do something, and so I requested of my commander to let me sign up for active duty,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, like, I knew I wanted in, you know, I wanted to be part of the team,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so. So that's what I ended up doing, was I signed up for active duty, and I ended up getting assigned to the 10th Mountain Division at Fort Drum, New York. And so so in so doing, they reclassified me from medical supply to unit supply, again thinking, oh, this is the same thing, right? Well, it's not, but okay. So they changed that on paper, and they said, oh, well, yeah, we see you have 10 years in the reserve. We see that you made it to the rank of E6, staff sergeant. You're in charge of your section. Yeah, we see that, but we don't feel like that experience is equivalent to active duty, so we're going to knock you down to E5 again. So there I was, again, Sergeant Rouse, but this time on active duty with the 10th Mountain Division. And so I ended up staying that rank for 3 years, because then it came down to, like, there's the technicality of, like, oh, you need time served on active duty in order to earn the next rank up, and so that meant that I got to be that rank for the whole time. but it actually ended up being the learning experience that I needed, and it,
mm-hmm.
and like I said, the, you know, I still believe now, years later, that the best rank in the Army is E5, is a sergeant, because you do the most. And I wanted to do, and I did. You know, I did a ton of work on active duty, and I had good people who worked for me, and it was a really, it was overall a really valuable, you know, professional experience as well as a personal experience, and I'm still in touch with a lot of those folks who I served with on active duty, and so that stint on active duty included a 12 months in Afghanistan. And you know, not everything was a great experience, but it felt very important what we were doing, and I was with some really fantastic people.
Can you talk about those 12 months a little? What stands out? How was it a learning experience for you, just being over there?
Well, a lot of my work doing unit supply or logistics for, you know, unit level logistics was, my heavy lifting was really getting us to Afghanistan and getting us home, like equipment wise, you know. So,
yeah.
You know, my part was making sure that we had all of our equipment tracked, packed, loaded, accounted for. If stuff came up missing, which it did, you know, then you have to properly account for it, and do all the paperwork right, or that value is going to come out of somebody's paycheck, you know. So, because stuff costs money in the Army, and people will get charged for it if you don't take care of them right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was in charge of several million dollars worth of equipment, and nobody had to pay for anything unless they admitted, like, yeah, I totally broke that or lost it. You know, like, that was the only time that they were charged for it. Because, if everyone's making an honest effort to take care of things and it wasn't their fault that it came up missing, then I was the one who made sure that was documented and that went through correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And so I felt like I did my job well with that. And it's a lot of details. It's more details. Like, I'm a detail person, and it was a lot more details than I would have ever thought. And then while we were in Afghanistan, I was, oddly enough, with a medical unit, but I wasn't doing a medical job. I kept flipping, you know, flip-flopping this, you know, medical to regular logistics, you know, which, maybe it's hard to explain, but it's been sort of a funny thing where I'm always, like, sort of touching things that are medical, but I'm never a medical person. But so we were augmenting the large hospital at Bagram Airfield, which is north of Kabul in Afghanistan. Like, that's the big base there. And it was the biggest hospital there. And so we had staff, like doctors, nurses, specialists, like medical specialists, and then medics, you know, who were helping to staff that hospital. And then we also had teams of medics and medical providers that were kind of spread all over. We had a team in Kandahar, which is in southern Afghanistan. We had and then we had just teams kind of all over eastern Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had a couple folks who were in Mazar-e-Sharif in the north. And so my job was to be a point of contact, to make sure that they had what they needed if they weren't getting it where they were on ground, which happened a lot. And I also made an effort to actually get out and see everybody. And I think I got out to see everybody except for the guys in the north. Just to see what their lives were like. And so in some ways it was sort of, they call it combat tourism, you know, like where you're getting on the helicopters and just flying around just to see what's going on, you know, and getting on a convoy just to see what's up. And so I did that. And so I felt like I got to, you know, like when you show up to people's bases and they're isolated, like the first thing they want to do is show you how they live and to tell you everything that's been going on. And so I feel like I kind of got like I got what everyone was doing in a really unique way that I think a lot of people in my unit didn't get to have that experience to see what everybody was doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like they were kind of focused on what they were doing. And then I also got to work with some other parts of our medical task force. Like we had a Korean medical unit that worked with us, and an Egyptian medical unit that worked with us as well. And so I got to work with you know, the Egyptian hospital liaison staff and the Korean, you know, and so it was just sort of a really interesting sort of cross-cultural talk that I really valued. And then when that year, like the 10th Mountain Division, we had our division in Afghanistan, we had our division headquarters, and we had our 3rd Brigade combat team that was there, and we also had an aviation brigade, and I was part of the sustainment brigade that was kind of there as like, you know, like that back end logistical support for everybody. But 10th Mountain had a pretty rough ride, that tour in 2006 was when it was. So we got there, like my unit got there at the end of January 2006, but as the weather warmed up, that's fighting season for the Taliban and affiliates, but by the time it really warmed up, like, you know, April, May, June, the fighting was really bad, and I think at least like on the ground, you know, like on the bottom level, like we didn't expect those kind of like casualties, you know, like, and it was always like, if it wasn't someone you knew, it was someone who you knew, or, you know, and or just a few people removed, or you would hear the stories of what happened, and it was some tough stuff, and, you know, and then in retrospect, like just within the last few years, like some of those 10th Mountain folks have been awarded posthumously, which is tragic, but they've been awarded medals of honor, you
mm-hmm.
know, for just the incredible things that they did in really, really horrible situations, and I knew some folks who were out there, you know, and so, you know, like while I myself wasn't out there, it was just you kind of feel like you're part of that big team effort, and like those are your guys, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Or a friend of mine who's out at a remote base, you know, like I remember, you know, she emailed me while I'm sitting at the hospital in Bagram, and she's like, oh, hey, Sergeant so-and-so got in a bad thing, and
mm-hmm.
and he's in the ER, can you check up on him? And, you know, and I went and checked up on him, and he was doing okay, and, you know, but he was knocked out, and I just went and like bought him some guy magazines and candy and stuff, and just brought that to him, just to, you know, because you can feel like you're alone, you know, if you're not with your unit, you know, and so, like, you know, like, just to be able to do just something personal for somebody just felt like I was helping in some ways, or,
mm-hmm.
you know, and because it's just, like, everything you do feels important, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it is, and in my other deployments, I've told my soldiers who feel like, oh, well, I'm not doing anything spectacular here, this isn't the war I signed up for, but, you know, I've tried to stress to them that, you know, like, your job is important. It's, you know, like, you are enabling other people to do what they need to do. You know, like, it's a team effort. It takes everybody, otherwise
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't be there. It was really valuable to be part of that big team effort.
Mm. Do you stay in touch with a lot of the people that you are close to over there?
Mm. I do. I'm probably not in as good a touch as I should be.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, if it wasn't for stuff like Facebook, I may not be as in touch. But you know, it was funny, like that 2006 deployment year, like that's when I guess like MySpace was like just starting to be a thing. And so like one of the soldiers who was like out at some remote place, like they had internet access, you know, it wasn't continuous, and you're still like you're living in a dump and you have mice and critters and E. coli in the water and, you know, stuff, like you're living in pretty rugged conditions, but they had MySpace, you know. And so we would talk to each other on stuff like that. And then in other deployments, you'll use Facebook to keep in touch with people on your camp or at the next outpost over or whatever, because it's just sort of like an easier way sometimes to keep in touch. And, you know, like you don't want to tell any details, you know, of like, oh, well, these grid coordinates and there was this operation and the bombs. And, you know, like you don't tell that kind of stuff, but just to say, hey, you doing all right? Yeah. And so we've just sort of like continued that as the social media has evolved. You know, we've all kind of continued that and had it grow. And I'll talk to people on the phone every once in a while or catch up by email. And everybody is just sort of like fixed in my life as, you know, like if anybody called me up and said, hey, I need to get out of jail or something, like I'd do whatever I could, you know, because it was, you know, a bunch of great folks who did some really amazing things.
A lot of shared experience, too.
Yeah. And also just like from where I got to be sort of an observer of everybody, it's like I saw firsthand what they were doing, and I was just, and it's so impressive just to see somebody like 20, 21 years old just doing these extraordinary things, you know, like saving lives, making a difference, being sort of like frontline diplomats to Afghans, to whatever forces we're working with. I mean, it's a tremendous responsibility, and these people like aren't even old enough to drink, you know. It was just really amazing to see what they were doing and the kind of lives they were living, and it, you know, and it was hard for them, you know, and again, I keep returning to the word important. Like, it was just so important what they were doing.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about how you lived while you were over there? You're talking about the living conditions of other people at different bases, and just I'm so curious about kind of the day-to-day, like what it was like for you when you woke up in the morning, when you went to sleep at night, where you lived, who you saw, that kind of thing.
Well, so I've done 3 deployments total, and I usually live pretty well, you know, like especially compared to other people,
yeah.
You know, and some of it is, you know, I've always done logistics, and so like, you know, like logistics always ends up with kind of the best deal. That first deployment, I had a supply room, and I was able to live in my supply room, and so I had part of what I brought with me were hand tools, like a circular saw and a toolbox and all kind of stuff. And so there were some things that were built in this plywood building that I took up as my supply room, and I ended up like sort of deconstructing what I didn't like, and then using like even the nails and screws that I pulled out, that's what I used to hammer back in to like build my own bed, to build a wall, to build, you know, to build shelves, to make a desk, and to, you know, all this kind of stuff. So we, you know, so like the first few weeks we were there, it was like, you know, we were sort of like a, you know, the, like we call it, you know, like the ghetto fabulous, you know, a plywood workshop, you know, and you know, people were arguing over like, well, who has the saw, who has the hammer, do you have any nails, no, you find your own nails, look what I did, you know. So like that was something that we were all doing, but I had it pretty good, so I didn't have to share a plywood hut with like 7 other people, you know, like a lot of other people did. And somebody prior to me had built sort of a deck, a private deck out in the
plywood
in the,
deck.
Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, and they covered it up with camo netting, and so a lot of people didn't know it was there, and we were able to get some hammocks and sort of make
nice.
Like a little, you know, a little hideaway.
It's like a resort.
Yeah.
There.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, for where we were, you know, because
yeah.
like anywhere you could go and feel like you have privacy. Like, I think that's what comes at a premium is private space. You know, like you can live in dirt, you can live in, you know, like where you have to walk, you know, 5 or 10 minutes to go to the bathroom or to take a shower or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But you can deal with that, but it's just sort of not having any completely private space that kind of gets to you. And so you kind of find your own ways to have your own quiet or whatever it is that you like.
Mm-hmm.
My second deployment, I lived with 5 other people in a 6-person plywood hut, and when I was on my base. But then I've been out to like other outposts where you live in like not so great stuff. Like
mm-hmm.
it's kind of, you know, like weird mattresses bought on the local bazaar that are, you know, just sort of like these weird foam pads that have been used by you don't know how many people before you, and it's, you know, and there's vermin and bugs and
mm-hmm.
and it's, you know, or the toilets where they burn, you know, they like you do your business in a bucket and they take it out and they burn it. You know, like that type of thing. Like I've visited those places, and it's interesting.
Yeah.
but like with anything, like you adjust to it.
Yeah.
You don't forget that you're inconvenienced, but you adjust to it, and then, you know, I'm still thankful for, you know, running water that is, you know, that doesn't have E. coli or detergents or whatever in it. You know.
Mm-hmm.
That is also contained in your living space, you know,
yeah.
that you don't have to go walk to.
Totally.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing now and kind of your transition from what you were doing into now?
So I've been in the National Guard the
mm-hmm.
last 6+ years, and I've had 2 deployments in the National Guard, like sort of flipping back and forth between a civilian life in New York City and then deploying. And so I got back from my last deployment in January.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had the same job for the city the last 5 years, and they've been really very patient and good to me to just, I mean, like they're, you know, I'm protected by law, you know, like where you have to let somebody, you know, like you have to let somebody in the Guard Reserve, like, go do what they need to do for the military and then come back, but you're not obligated by law to be nice about it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I work for the city. I work for the city's Office of Emergency Management, and it's a small agency, and they've always been really kind to me about that. And so I came back to my same job, and what I do is, you know, because I did logistics in the military, and I've done everything from, you know, like supplying a medical company to on my second tour, I was second in command of a company that did resupply and maintenance for an infantry battalion,
mm-hmm.
You know, where we were supporting, you know, 4 different infantry companies that had, you know, they were responsible for, you know, districts of an Afghan province, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so and running convoys, and so I was involved in the mission planning and tracking, you know, the stuff, you
mm-hmm.
know, that needed to be done, or the missions, or the you know, briefing what we were doing on a daily basis or on a every few days basis, depending on who we were talking to, and, you know,
mm-hmm.
working with the Afghan army. I was working with the sort of our counterparts in the Afghan army who did resupply, convoys, and maintenance for their, you know, troops, and so it was, so that was a really valuable experience too. And then Last year I was part of the drawdown with equipment wise, like I was responsible for putting those giant trucks, the MRAPs, onto planes to get flown out of Afghanistan, because we couldn't get them out by ground because the border was closed. And so I was at Bagram Airfield again, but basically like tracking what was going on military aircraft, and working directly with the Air Force to make sure that we were maximizing what we needed to do, you know, like getting more trucks on C-17s, you know, that type of thing, or getting more flights, you know, for our cargo to go on. And so it's all like, it's all logistics, right? And so, so I've taken that experience and the fact that I have, you know, some training in English, so I can do logistics and write about it. So that's what I do for New York City.
Nice, using your English.
Yeah,
it
kind of it's a funny combination of things that I know how to do that just sort of works out for my job with the city. So so I do logistics planning for emergencies. So so it's been good. You know, my experience in the military has definitely added up toward very positive things for me, and it's not without, you know, I mean, like when you go to war, bad things happen in war, you know. There's a lot of hard things about those tours that I've had, but on a personal development standpoint, I think, I mean, it's added up to a lot of positive things for me that I've been able to get out of it. And and being in 19 years and different aspects of the Army, like it's really just sort of infused with, it's sort of who I am, you know. And and in some ways I'm kind of like, I don't know that I can envision my life without the Army. and some people say like, oh, you just don't know when to quit, but it's, and it's also been a place where I've been able to give back, you know. So because when I left active duty, when I got, you know, when I did my 3 years of service that I signed up for with 10th Mountain Division, you know, I got off active duty, I was done being enlisted, and I signed up for the National Guard, and I decided to become an officer. And so I've made it to the rank of captain, and I've gotten to see sort of like, you know, I spent the first 13 years of my career hating officers, right? And then I decided to become one. And so it's, I feel like I kind of get to see both viewpoints and have some more understanding, I hope, of what it's about. And you know, and I've made plenty of mistakes, you know, as anybody does, but I think that it's all made me a much better person and a better leader, and a better professional to learn some of those hard lessons, you know, and to do what I can with it, you know, and to hopefully make things better for people who are coming up in the ranks, you know, to remember what it feels like to be the PV2, just brand new in the Army. Even if basic training is a little different now, or easier, maybe it's easier.
What words of wisdom would you give to somebody who's just starting out? Maybe they're like you, maybe they were in, you know, a minimum wage job, and they're like, where am I going to go with my life? Maybe I'll join the Army. Maybe that would be a good idea for me. What would you tell people who are considering that as an option for themselves? Or what would you ask?
Well, I think everybody comes to the military like because they want to be better in some way, you know, like they want to be more, they want to do more, you know, they may want the college money, they may want the job training or the whatever, but still, like, something in you just wants to be more, and you want to do that in the context of national service, you know, because there's a world of things that you could pick out there to do, but to say I want to make myself better by giving my service to my country, you know, like there's something really special in that, and I think it's always important, like, at any level to honor that, whatever that impulse is, you know. It's really an amazing thing to have an all-volunteer military. Like, who can sustain that? We can.
Mm-hmm.
Because people still want to come to this and do this, you know, and serve in that way and grow through it. But, you know, that being said, I still tell them, you know, be careful what you wish for and you know, you watch in the news, you know, are you paying attention to what's going on? Because, you know, you might be right there. Even if your recruiter didn't, even if your recruiter explicitly told you, oh, you're not going to war, which apparently recruiters still tell people, or they've been telling people this whole time, oh, yeah. Oh, there's those wars that are happening, but yeah, you're not going to go. And there's these young kids who still believe it. And then they'll come to you in your unit, and they're like, yeah, my recruiter told me I wouldn't have to go anywhere. And it sounds like a cliche, but I've heard it from multiple people. And I say to them, I'm like, have you ever watched CNN? But I would ask them, like, what are your expectations? You know, what are you expecting? And then whatever you're expecting, it's going to be different. You know, I guarantee you it's going to be different. But if you're willing to, you know, like, you get out of it what you put into it, and if you're willing to give, then you're going to get a lot. And it may be the best thing you do.
Mm-hmm.
It may be the best thing you do. It's been one of the best things I've done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and again, that's not to say that there haven't been, you know, things that I regret or things that make me sad or things that you wish wouldn't happen the way that they happened or that could have been prevented. You know what I mean? Like, it's, you know, like, there's, you know, like, you open yourself up to the full spectrum of life experiences that make you mad, make you sad, make you proud, make you whatever, but I think you can walk away from it feeling really proud of the people that you're with, and that's what gives me the pride in my organization, is not to say, look what I did, but to say, like, look at these amazing, fabulous people who are doing incredible things, and I was part of that team effort.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything that you want to add to this that you didn't talk about? I'm sure we can't even begin to capture everything in a conversation just in one evening, but is there anything else that you want to make sure that future generations hear when they listen to this conversation?
I think there's always, like, the, like, if you're in a history class and you look back at you know, like, a particular conflict or war, and you know, sometimes if our political leaders make this or that choice, then that military endeavor will be remembered as, like, oh, well, that was, they're, everybody who participated in that is a hero, no, like, kind of no matter what they did, you know, or what they did or didn't do, you know. And again, like, that service, whether you're drafted or whether you volunteer, like, you still do it, you still have a choice of whether you do it or not, and the choice to serve, I think, is an honorable thing, you know. But people in history classes will say, like, oh, well, that thing was just a horrible idea. Why did anybody want to go to that? People just should have stayed home, you know, and just said,
mm-hmm.
I'm not going to participate, and then you can't fight a war, can you? You know, but I think the important thing that I would want to get across to future generations is that military people are not political in what they're doing. We may have political beliefs, we may be politically active as citizens, we may be completely against a war. But if we have chosen to serve, it, like, the politics go away, because it, you know, there's not a Democrat war, there's not a Republican war. There is a war that the nation's elected leaders, through our constitutionally mandated process, you know, have said, yes, we're going to do this, or no, we're not going to do that. And so the decision to serve is saying, you know what, right or wrong, I'm going to be part of what my country's elected officials decide on, you know, and you go, and you do your job, and you do your job to take care of the people in your unit. You do your job to, you know, to represent your country. You do, you know, like, to represent your personal values of, you know, I'm going to serve. I'm going to do the right thing in this situation. And that is why you serve. And it's not a political choice. It's a choice of loyalty to your country. You know, sort of the right or wrong part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you just hope that the people way up high, who you get to vote for or not, make the right policy choices. And then if you don't like that policy choice, then maybe you can vote differently next time, or maybe you can, you know, if life leads you a certain way, then maybe you can be the one in office one day making different political choices, you know, because this is America and we get to live like this.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not a, wartime service is not a political thing.
Anything else that you want to add before I push the stop button?
Dear people in the future, we need better flavors of MREs. Meals ready to eat. More vegetarian options.
Thank you.
Great. Good point. Well, thank you so much. This is really, really amazing for me to hear.